Welcome to this edition of Forthright Radio for February 5th, 2020. I'm Joy LaClaire. We have a very full show for you today. While the United States Senate votes whether to convict on two articles of impeachment against President Donald J. Trump for abuse of power and obstruction of Congress, Russia is celebrating the 75th anniversary of the Yalta Conference, also known as the Crimean Conference, which was attended by the three leaders of the Allied nations, Franklin Roosevelt, Winston Churchill, and Joseph Stalin, from February 4th through the 11th, 1945, before the end of the Second World War that year. On the way home from that meeting, Roosevelt traveled to the Great Bitter Lake in the Suez Canal, where he met King Abdulaziz ibn Saud, founder of Saudi Arabia, aboard the U.S. cruiser Quincy. Whether it's the Russian invasion of Crimea, the political tensions between Arabs and Jews in Israel and the Palestinian territories, or fossil fuel extraction and consumption and the accelerating manifestation of climate disruption, the geopolitics of those meetings continue to spin into the present. And returning to Forthright Radio today to discuss aspects of this is Professor Michael T. Clare, whose latest book, All Hell Breaking Loose, The Pentagon's Perspective on Climate Change, was published in November of 2019 by Metropolitan Books. Michael Clare is the five-college professor of peace and world security studies, which is a joint appointment at Amherst, Hampshire, Mount Holyoke, and Smith Colleges, and the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, positions he has held since 1985. In this capacity, he has taught courses in arms control and disarmament, contemporary conflicts dynamics, and global resource politics at all five member institutions. Professor Clare is the defense correspondent of The Nation magazine and is a contributing editor of Current History. He also serves on the board of directors of the Arms Control Association and the National Priorities Project. Professor Clare originated the concept of extreme energy, which is a range of techniques for the production of energy from unconventional resources, which share characteristics of being environmentally damaging or risky. Examples include exploitation of oil sands, shale oil, deepwater drilling, hydraulic fracturing, mountaintop removal mining, petroleum exploration in the Arctic, and natural gas hydrates. Among his many books are Resource Wars, The New Landscape of Global Conflict, Blood and Oil, The Dangers and Consequences of America's Growing Dependency on Imported Petroleum, Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources, and most recently, All Hell Breaking Loose, The Pentagon's Perspective on Climate Change. And with that, by way of introduction, we welcome you back to Forthright Radio, Professor Michael Clare.
Well, Joy, thank you so much for that lovely introduction and description of the work I've done. It seems like, looking back, I didn't know I had done so much. So thank you very much.
Well, you certainly have, and we were originally scheduled to have this interview on January 15th, 2020, which was Martin Luther King Jr.'s actual birthday, and I had prepared an introduction honoring his legacy, but NPR's coverage of the impeachment hearings forced us to reschedule, and we really appreciate your flexibility in joining us today instead. There is one part of that introduction, however, which I share with our listeners, and it's a very short quote, and here it is, quote, "Nothing in all the world is more dangerous than sincere ignorance and conscientious stupidity," end of the quote, Martin Luther King Jr. Well, Professor Clare, you begin your book, All Hell Breaking Loose, The Pentagon's Perspective on Climate Change, with these words, and I'm quoting you now. Shortly after assuming the presidency in 2017, Donald Trump rescinded Executive Order 13653, titled Preparing the United States for the Impacts of Climate Change, a measure that had been signed by President Barack Obama in late 2013. That's the end of the quote. And you have written about what followed. So what did happen in the administration after the rescission of that order?
So this was one of the steps that Trump took immediately after assuming office as president. He had pledged that he would roll back the environmental initiatives of the Obama administration, and one of the main steps he took was to rescind that presidential directive, which had called on all federal agencies, that is the Obama directive, had called on all federal agencies first to assess what their vulnerabilities were to climate change and its consequences, and then to take whatever action they thought was necessary to reduce their exposure to climate change and also to reduce their contribution to global warming, to cut back on fossil fuel use in particular. So what Trump did was say, stop all of that, roll back all those efforts, stop doing anything related to climate change. And what I say next in my book is that virtually all federal agencies, which are now dominated by Trump appointees, said, yes, sir, we'll do what you say. But the largest federal organization, the U.S. Department of Defense, has not gone along with that directive. They continue, although without talking openly about climate change, to prepare for its effects, because they are at great risk from climate effects in their ability to carry out what they see as their primary duties. And they see climate change as a threat to national security, and they've sworn their lives to protect this country against threats to the nation. And they see climate change as one of those threats.
We've done several shows, actually, over the years that address the fact that the Department of Defense has recognized that this is a security risk. But most of those have focused on just the physical stuff, like rising sea levels and naval bases, that sort of thing. But you go much more deeply into the global responsibilities that, whether you think it's a good idea or not, then the United States Department of Defense has taken on. In fact, the entire globe is broken up into six regional command centers. Would you very briefly just talk about the command centers and how the globe is distributed that way?
Absolutely. I almost think this is like the Roman model of provinces that were governed by proconsuls appointed by Rome, and they had control over Roman legions in their districts around the Roman Empire. It's not so different from that. The U.S. Department of Defense has these regional combatant commands, or geographic combatant commands, they're called. Those include the Pacific Command, which is now called the Indo-Pacific Command. It stretches from the Indian Ocean to the Pacific. Then there's the Central Command, which covers the Middle East and Central Asia. That includes Afghanistan and Iraq and Syria and the Persian Gulf. There's the Africa Command. That doesn't need explanation. The European Command. The Southern Command, which includes South America and the Caribbean. The Northern Command, which includes the United States, Canada, and North America. So each one of these geographic combatant commands has their own unified commander who controls all the forces within his or her region and has more power, I would say, within their region than any American diplomat or ambassador, because they have so much more vast vastly more powers to exercise and money within that region. But the thing about these commands is that they're deeply embedded in the regions they operate. So take the Africa command. The people who serve there spend a lot of time in Africa. And because they spend time there and interact with local officers from the militaries of the region they serve in, they've had a first-hand exposure to climate change effects that few other American officials have, because they're out in the field. They're out in the Sahel region, which is the southern branch of the Sahara Desert. This is Mali, Somalia, Niger, Mauritania, northern Nigeria. This is where you see a lot of insurgency, a lot of terrorism, a lot of ethnic violence. And they've seen, that is, American officers have seen how profound, prolonged drought and water scarcity and food scarcity has contributed to the violence in that region. So these officers have had a first-hand eyes-on look at the impacts of climate change on fragile states and fragile institutions that few other Americans have. And they've reported back to the Pentagon and to their superior officers. And it's in this respect, I think, that the U.S. military has a unique understanding of the impacts of climate change that even many academics don't have. They understand that global warming is already contributing to violence, intergroup violence, to state collapse, to mass migrations and pandemics in many vulnerable areas of the world.
Yes, and one of the concepts that you discuss in your book is the concept of the threat multiplier. Talk about that, please.
As I say, these officers have served in areas of the world, many of them in the poorer areas in the developing world. This, after all, is where insurgencies have occurred in Syria, civil wars and insurgencies in Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, and so on. These are places which were already prone to violence because of poverty, because of histories of intergroup violence, because of poor state institutions and corruption and authoritarianism. So they were already prone to violence. Along comes climate change, drying up rivers, drying up sources of water, pushing people to the very edge of survival. And under those circumstances, states that were barely hanging on collapse utterly, creating chaos and civil war. So climate change is seen as, you might call it, the straw that breaks the camel's back, the force, the pressure that pushes weak states in over the brink into disaster. So they call it a threat multiplier because in all of these areas of the Middle East and North Africa, in Central Asia, water is scarce to begin with. And without water, you can't grow crops or feed your animals. And everybody in these areas depends on agriculture or herding to survive. And climate change is taking away what remains of the water. And when that happens, no society can survive. And that's what they mean by a threat multiplier.
Much later in your book, you talk about the massive heat wave in Russia in 2010 and that impacted the wheat crop that year. And then in 2011, we reported quite a bit on the Arab Spring, and I knew that there were food issues involved in the rise up of the populations in many of the Arab countries in North Africa and the Middle East. But I didn't realize the connection between the Russian heat wave in 2010 and the wheat shortage in those countries, with bread prices rising and rising up 30% or more. That connection was never known to me until your book brought it out.
Well, thank you. Yes, I didn't understand this either until I studied it. The Russian heat wave, which was unprecedented in 2010, nothing like it. Temperatures in Moscow above 100 degrees, fires burning all over the country. Picture Australia today. That's what Russia was like in 2010. And it burned about a fifth of Russia's wheat crop. And Russia had been a net exporter of wheat, especially to the Middle East, to Egypt and to Libya and to Tunisia and Syria, all these countries which depend heavily on imported wheat to produce the bread that their population depended on, the poor population depended on to a great degree for their daily food intake. So Russia banned food exports when so much of its crop burned up in that horrible hot summer of 2010. And immediately prices jumped, some cases doubled overnight in parts of North Africa and the Middle East. And this was the threat multiplier that we're speaking of. Societies that were already had a lot of grievances against their governments, their authoritarian governments in Egypt and Tunisia and Libya, Syria, a lot of poverty, a lot of discontent, and when food prices doubled bread prices especially doubled overnight, virtually overnight, that was the spark that triggered the Arab Spring. And you could trace it back to this heat wave in Russia, which was clearly caused by climate change. There's no other explanation for those giant fires and high temperatures. It's the same in Australia right now. There's no other possible explanation for record-breaking temperatures day after day, year after year, and a scarcity of water.
We're speaking with Michael T. Clare about his latest book, All Hell Breaking Loose, The Pentagon's Perspective on Climate Change. Okay, let's get back to the Pentagon. You enumerate what you write about as the ladder of escalation. What do you mean by that, and what are the steps on this ladder?
So, yes, I compare what we're seeing today with respect to the climate to what nuclear theorists talked about in the early days of the Cold War. Back in those days, people might think of Herman Kahn and Dr. Strangelove. They developed the term the ladder of escalation to talk about how a small little clash with the Soviet Union, this was back when there was a Soviet Union, that a clash between U.S. and Soviet troops, say over Berlin, which may be one tank or a few tanks, would escalate rapidly to a bigger clash, then to the first use of nuclear weapons, and then to all-out use of nuclear weapons, and one step after the other. That's the ladder of escalation. And what I see happening with climate and the military foresees is that we're going to go from the kinds of effects we're seeing today, rising seas, burning forests, severe drought, to much more systemic impacts that will occur all over the world simultaneously, creating wars, chaos, mass migrations, pandemics, all at the same time, making it impossible for the U.S. military to do its job and defend the nation. That's what I mean by an all-hell-breaking-loose scenario. And we see elements of that already.
You divide it into six steps. The first one you describe is humanitarian disaster relief. So that's the it appears that you're doing it in order of difficulty. So this is what you seem to analyze as the least problematic. So briefly talk about the issues around humanitarian disaster relief. Now, this is from the point of view of the military, right?
Yes, yes. So this is from the demand level that would be placed on U.S. military forces, from the lowest level of demand to the highest level of demand. So at the lowest level of demand would be what they call humanitarian assistance and disaster relief, HADR, where they would send, in the case of a hurricane that would strike a friendly country like the Philippines in 2013, with Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines, when the U.S. sent a dozen naval ships, an aircraft carrier, and thousands of troops to help overcome a disaster there and then leave. But there was no fighting involved. It was purely the delivery of emergency relief supplies. A higher level would be when those kinds of disaster relief measures occur when a country is already on the brink of conflict and the state may be falling apart. And relief missions are met in some cases by armed resistance or by chaos and rioting and violence, where the aid workers have to be defended by armed troops. That would be a next level of conflict where next step on the ladder of escalation where the aid workers are facing violence as well as just delivering supplies. A next higher level is when a state, an ally, let's say Nigeria or the Philippines, faces such the severity of the climate disaster is so great that the state, the government, is unable to function and disintegrates, and you have mass chaos and intergroup violence on a very large scale threatening vital U.S. interests, and the U.S. military has to go in and restore order. And we haven't quite come to that yet, but that could be just around the corner. An even higher level is when wars break out between major powers as a result of climate change. And I see that day occurring in the not-too-distant future. That could occur, for example, between India and China over water in the Himalayas. That could precipitate a nuclear war. Or between India and Pakistan over the waters of the Indus River. It could also occur, even a higher level is, and this is on my mind now, in the Arctic region, where the Arctic is melting, the Arctic ice cap is melting.
Among the things that Professor Clare enumerates to exemplify some of these problems is the disruption of global supply chains. And we sort of discussed that already with the heat wave in Russia leading, at least in part, to the Arab Spring of 2011. And just as an aside, you mentioned the problem between Pakistan and India. Another thing I learned from your book is that the beginnings, the headwaters of the Indus River are in Kashmir. And I had always understood the conflict between India and Pakistan in Kashmir as primarily a religious one of the Hindu versus the Muslim. But the plot thickens when you realize that the water supplies in the western part of India and the eastern part of Pakistan are in Kashmir. Do you have any further comments on that?
Well, yes, I should be clear. The Indus River draws upon the original Indus. Itself originates in the Himalayas and passes through China and then comes down into Pakistan. But its full flow depends on a number of tributaries, three of the main tributaries, originate come from Kashmir, from Indian-controlled Kashmir. So a large part of the actual water that flows into the Indus does originate in Kashmir. Not all of it, but a lot of it. And it's crucial for agriculture in the Punjab area in Pakistan. So there is a treaty between India and Pakistan, the Indus River Treaty, that requires that India not divert that water unilaterally. But there are fears in Pakistan that the Indians, as a reprisal to Pakistan, could dam those rivers before they flow from Kashmir into Pakistan as a form of punitive action. And those fears have been revived in recent months when the Modi government in India has seized total control of Kashmir. Before it had a degree of autonomy. Now it's totally controlled by the Indian military. So there are fears in Pakistan that India will go ahead with threats to further dam those rivers and prevent their flow into Pakistan, which would be utterly catastrophic for agriculture there and could prompt conflict between the two countries, both of which, of course, are nuclear armed.
Okay, so we've been talking about the ladder of escalation on a global scale and looking outward from the continental United States, but the Department of Defense also has to deal with, or is increasingly posing, the issue of domestic disasters, and Hurricane Harvey in August of 2017 is a prime example of that. Please remind our listeners of what happened then and the role that the military was required to play.
Okay, well, I think this deserves close attention. It's not just Harvey. Harvey was followed by Hurricane Irma, and that was followed by Hurricane Maria. So this was a triple threat, three hurricanes in a row. And this is important for several reasons. It tells us that climate change is going to result not just in episodic disasters, but in clusters of disasters that are happening simultaneously, one right after another. And this is going to put tremendous stress on government institutions to try to deal with this kind of intensity of impact. And that was true in 2017. First came Hurricane Harvey. Now, all of these hurricanes were unusual in many respects, in the intensity of the storm, and in the case of Harvey, that it sucked up so much water from the Gulf of Mexico, and then it just lingered over Houston and dumped more water, more rain on that city than ever in any place in the United States before. So this was an unprecedented, extraordinary storm that flooded that city and caused immense damage. So the U.S. military responded by sending tens of thousands of troops there and all kinds of equipment, ships, planes, personnel, vehicles that could go through water, and the whole nine yards. They performed very well. They did a great job to help out. But then came Irma 10 days later, which hit Florida and the islands, and they had to redirect all of those troops and equipment, which was a big logistical operation. Another tens of thousands of troops were moved into Florida to deal with Irma's impact. And then 10 days or so later came Hurricane Maria, which utterly devastated Puerto Rico. And so far as we know, the island has never recovered from that. And again, the Department of Defense mobilized more troops, more ships, more planes to help with that. And I give credit to the Department of Defense for the assistance that they provided to the people in all of those places. But it showed the kind of demands and pressures they're going to have to face in the future as these kinds of disasters multiply and occur simultaneously in many places. Now, those of you in Mendocino will remember that this is the time of fires that occurred in Sonoma County. And the Department of Defense
And Mendocino County, I should let you know, we had deaths in Mendocino County then, even though the U.S. media focused mostly on Sonoma County. But, yes, we had our share of grief there, too.
All right, then. So you know what I'm talking about. And all of this was occurring simultaneously. So for the Department of Defense, this was an unprecedented level of demand on their forces. And they responded brilliantly, or as best they could, with what they had. Now, fortunately, we were not at war at that time, other than the current wars in Afghanistan and in Iraq. But there was no other demand. But if you could imagine, in the ladder of escalation scenario we were talking about, where U.S. forces were needed in numerous other places around the world, this would be an impossible situation for the Pentagon to deal with. They wouldn't have enough assets and capacities to deal with all of these crises simultaneously. And this is the fear that the military has, that as we go further into the future and climate change gains momentum, becomes truly a massive crisis, that their ability to carry out their function to defend the nation will disappear. And this is why they're so concerned about climate change, even though their commander-in-chief says it doesn't exist.
In reference to what you're saying about Hurricane Marie and Puerto Rico and the complex catastrophes, we have only been discussing the climate disruption-related issues. But then there are the other ones, like the repeated earthquakes that Puerto Rico is having. So there can be other phenomena besides just the climate ones, and they multiply the grief and the problems involved. Another thing that isn't usually discussed is the U.S. critical infrastructure, which has been deemed highly vulnerable. Talk about that, please.
Oh, yes. This is something that people in the Department of Defense and some civil authorities are deeply, deeply concerned about, and that is the nature of America's energy and transportation infrastructure is extremely vulnerable to the effects of global warming. That's partly, or to a great extent, due to the fact that our cities, many of our most populated areas, are located along our coastlines or along rivers in the interior. So in the East Coast, where I'm speaking from, you know, most of the airports, the railroads, the major highways, the pipelines, and the transmission lines are located very close to the coast. And in the future, when sea levels can rise 6 feet or 10 feet by the end of the century, is the likely prediction now, all of those will be inundated and destroyed. And so the ability of the nation to function will cease in these scenarios. In the West Coast, you're very vulnerable to fires. I don't have to tell you folks in Northern California about that. When the fires come, transmission lines are shut down or destroyed, highways are blocked. This is the future that people who worry about these things see, and they know that the situation is going to get much, much worse.
Just speaking personally, I was born in Annapolis, Maryland, and that is the home of the U.S. Naval Academy, and they're already, I think there are 50 flood tides a year at this point in Annapolis, so the Naval Academy is taking steps since about 2012 or 2014, I believe, to raise their seawall, but to me, that just seems like a
Band-aid is the word.
Thank you. I was trying to think of a diplomatic choice,
yes,
of words.
Annapolis is one of the most vulnerable military facilities in the country, along with Norfolk Naval Station in Norfolk, Virginia, because they're built on tidal flats, essentially, and they're already at close to sea level. but Annapolis will be underwater before the end of the century, and there's nothing that could be done, except to it could be turned into a protected island built within sea walls that could be reached by bridges if you want to spend hundreds of billions of dollars. But otherwise, these facilities will have to be moved further inland. And people in the Navy and in the Department of Defense know this perfectly well. And there are studies that have been produced by the Department of Defense identifying the most vulnerable bases in the United States. Annapolis is one of the ones at the top of the list, vulnerable to climate effects. And they know that money will have to be spent in large amounts just to defend them for the next decade or so. Beyond that, you know, it's hopeless. But they know this, which is why there is this gap between what the White House says and what people in the military say.
Okay, so we've been delivering some of the bad news.
Yes.
There is good news. And speaking of the Navy, I do come from a Navy family, so let's go there. They're going green. Tell us some of the things that they are doing and have already accomplished in terms of going green.
Yes. As I say, the people in the Navy in particular have been very aware of this. And, you know, that's true for a number of reasons. First of all, you know, a Navy base, by definition, is going to be on the coastline. And all of their bases on the East Coast are in places that are highly vulnerable, especially their biggest base, which is Norfolk Naval Station in Virginia. And that is repeatedly been flooded at high tides and during storm periods. And it's clear that Norfolk is in deep danger from climate change, and naval officers are aware of that, and they've been meeting with officials from Norfolk and from the state of Virginia. Their senator, Democratic Senator Tim Kaine, has been very involved trying to get Congress to appropriate funds to address these dangers. Some progress has been made at the local level to increase resiliency in Norfolk. So a lot of progress has been made at the local level to build better resiliency of the community, because communities surround these bases, where the people who work on the base live and all of the contractors that support the base are located, and the county officials and town officials are working together to address the future threats. So that's very positive, and it's happening in San Diego, too, where the same issues arise, and the Coronado Naval Base and local officials there are working together, because the federal government is doing nothing. So this has to happen more at the local level. The Navy is also working very hard to increase the efficiency of their ships and planes, to have more of their non-military vehicles be powered by renewable fuels or be all electric, so that they contribute less to the warming process. The Navy is also, I was talking about the Arctic, the Navy was the first military service to write about climate change early as 2010, and even earlier, because they face a challenge. The Navy never paid any attention to the Arctic before because their ships couldn't go there. It was covered with ice. Now the ice cap is melting, and the Arctic is becoming an area of great power contestation. Russia is aggressively building up its fleet in the Arctic, and China now is claiming that the Arctic is part of its area of interest and sending icebreakers and warships into the Arctic region. So the Navy is having to equip its forces, its ships, to be able to operate in the Arctic. This worries me because it could lead to a military clash there. And I see this as a great danger, but it also explains why the U.S. Navy has, from a very early period in this century, viewed climate change as a major factor in its strategic thinking.
Well, what about the Great Green Fleet?
Okay, the Great Green Fleet. Now, this was a initiative of the former Secretary of the Navy, and I have to remember his name, but he played a great role.
Ray Mabus?
Yes, thank you, Mabus. And he was the longest-serving Secretary of the Navy, and he began in 2010 to create a Great Green Fleet, a fleet that would be powered entirely by alternative fuels, which he included nuclear power. So in 2016, a fleet sailed off in the Pacific from San Diego, powered either a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, but all the other ships were powered by a alternative fuel combining some petroleum and also biofuels. And this was the first time a fleet sailed on a six-month tour or so that was not 100% nuclear and fossil fuels. And it was a demonstration. It was intended as a demonstration to show that the Navy could take leadership in developing alternative fuels, renewable fuels, as part of its technology, and also to show to other countries that they should do likewise. So there was a lot of showmanship involved. And I think this was a very impressive endeavor. Now, the current administration is not so keen on all of this, but nonetheless, a lot of the innovations that Mabus made in that period are still going forward, and the Navy is very keen to develop alternative systems. So some of
Professor Clare, let me interrupt you just a moment.
Yes.
I'm going to quote your book again about Mabus's vision. He had energy targets for 2020. First, half of all energy consumed at shore-based installations had to come from renewable on-site sources such as wind, solar, and geothermal. Second, petroleum use by Navy's fleet of 50,000 non-tactical commercial vehicles would be cut in half through the acquisition of hybrid and all-electric cars. Third, at least 40% of the Navy's total energy consumption would come from alternative sources. And fourth, as a capstone to all of this, the Navy would create a, quote, green strike group composed of nuclear vessels and ships powered by a biofuel mixture, the Great Green Fleet. That's the end of the quote. So that was his vision to accomplish by 2020. What grade would you give on the success of those accomplishments?
So the Navy has really taken a lot of leadership in this. I cannot give you a grade because, now this is what's unfortunate about having a denier as commander-in-chief, that the data that was previously available on progress is harder to find. You have to work harder at it. But I could say this, that the Navy has installed one of the largest solar power facilities in the country to supply 250,000, enough to supply 250,000 homes. This is in Southern California, to supply 14 of its bases from Sempra Power Systems. The facility is actually in Phoenix, Arizona, but it produces electricity to supply those facilities, and it's got 650,000 photovoltaic panels. It's one of the largest solar facilities in the United States. So they really are moving ahead in this direction, even though I can't give you precise data on the success of Mabus's initiatives.
Okay, well, let's leave the Navy for a moment and go to the other branches of the military. You report that one of the vulnerabilities in the Middle East, well, not the Middle East, but Iraq and Afghanistan, were supplying energy to forward operating bases. What has the military done to mitigate that?
So this has been a big effort by the Department of Defense, especially the Marine Corps now, which is a branch of the Navy, of course. The Marine Corps has been especially active because they want to be able to send their troops anywhere. And now we could talk about the politics of that, whether we agree with that or not. But putting that aside, the Marines want to be able to deploy their forces anywhere in the world. And in a lot of places that they've been deployed, say Afghanistan or Iraq, getting fuel to power their heavy equipment, their tanks or their armored vehicles and everything else they need, is proved exceedingly dangerous. So in Afghanistan, more soldiers were killed guarding convoys of oil than in any other activity. That was the most dangerous thing you could do in Afghanistan, was to drive a convoy of oil tankers to remote bases. So in response to that, this was not climate-driven, this was combat-driven, but in response to that, the Marines and the Army have taken the leadership in developing very innovative alternatives to fossil fuels to power remote bases, so they could free themselves. This is what Jim Mattis, General Jim Mattis, who was one of Trump's top Secretary of Defense until he resigned just recently, a big goal of his was to, as he said it, to free the military from the tether to fossil fuels. And so the Army and the Marines have done a lot of innovative research in mobile solar power, mobile wind power, and other renewable sources of energy that could be taken with them so they would not be dependent on fossil fuels. And a lot of this technology, you know, folding solar panels they developed that you could put in a backpack and then set up in the fields and power your radios with. This kind of technology has a lot of potential applications for civilian use.
Professor Clare, we're running out of time, and I want to leave you with a minute to say to our listeners what we weren't able to get to in your book, All Hell Breaking Loose.
Well, thank you. I wrote this book in the belief that the debate over climate change has gotten frozen to some degree in this country. There are many people who believe strongly that climate change or climate disruption poses a great threat to our country and requires action by Congress, by others, to write an emergency action to stop it. And we're aware of the protests, we're aware of that activity. There are many other people who feel that climate change isn't a threat, that it doesn't exist or it isn't a threat, and as a result, no progress is being made to address the problem. I wrote this book to show that there is another voice, and that is of the military. The military doesn't take a side on parts of this debate. What's causing climate change, or any of that? What they say is that climate change is real and that it poses a threat to the security of the United States, and therefore we have to take action to protect our country. And I'm hoping that that argument will help alter the debate in this country, that we could rally together to defend this country against this threat as a national security threat, as an act of patriotism. And I hope that this message will bridge some of this divide that's developed over in the debate over climate change.
Well, I think that you have done a tremendous service in writing this book. And if anything can do it, your analysis can and your research. Thank you so much for joining us again on Forthright Radio, Professor Michael Clare.
Well, thank you, Joy, for giving me this opportunity to lay out discussion, and I hope listeners will find it very useful. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you. Our guest today on Forthright Radio has been Professor Michael Clare. We've been discussing his research and his latest book, All Hell Breaking Loose, The Pentagon's Perspective on Climate Change, published by Metropolitan Books. The views and opinions expressed on Forthright Radio are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of this station's staff, its members, board of directors, or contributors. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production, broadcast usually each first and third Wednesday of the month from the Philo Studios of KZYX and Z, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Engineer Rich Culbertson, I'm Joy LaClaire. And you can hear past Forthright Radio programs by going to our website, forthright.media.